Penguin Random House Audio presents The Socialist Awakening, What's Different Now About the Left, by John B. Judas. Read for you by Holter Graham. Socialism, Old and New. The philosopher Frederick Jameson once wrote, "It is easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism." Jameson, hardly known as a staunch defender of capitalism, he's perhaps the world's foremost Marxist literary critic, didn't write this generations ago, but in 2003. In March 2020, as the novel coronavirus outbreak was putting millions of Americans under stay-at-home orders, and as Congress and the Federal Reserve had begun pouring trillions of dollars into the economy to soften the blow of a coming depression, Vox editor Dylan Matthews quipped, "The end of the world is making it easier to imagine the end of capitalism." The coronavirus pandemic came barely 5 years after the United States and Western Europe were finally recovering from the Great Recession of 2008. It has not, and will not, spell the end of the world or of capitalism, but it has put the final nail in the coffin of the laissez-faire globalized capitalism that prevailed since the days of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and that was perpetuated, wittingly or not, by their successors. The era of big government, which Bill Clinton claimed was over under his watch, is back with a vengeance, and so is the attention of politicians, if only for the time being, to the welfare of the many, not just the few. The politics and political economy in the United States and Europe, not to mention elsewhere, are entering a new era, just as it happened in the early 1930s, after World War II, and then again in the early 1980s. In the early 1930s, faced with the breakdown of the gold-based international monetary system and of untamed capitalism at home, the countries of the West went in very different directions. The United States went toward Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Central and Southern Europe went towards Nazism and fascism. Both alternatives, as socialist theorist Carl Polanyi described them in The Great Transformation, were attempts to use the power of government to protect the populace against the vicissitudes of the market. The failure of market capitalism has been heightened by the threat posed by the novel coronavirus. All the weaknesses of the previous era, from the over-reliance on global supply chains to underfunded social services, from tax avoidance by the wealthy and large corporations to the immiseration of what are known as essential workers, have been laid bare. And after the threat of the virus recedes, the countries of the world will still face steep unemployment and a daunting task of economic reconstruction, along with the growing threat of climate change that will require major public initiatives. These failures and weaknesses can be, as they were in the United States in the 1930s, the basis for a traditional left-wing alliance of the bottom and the middle of society against the very top. Or they can feed right-wing attempts to divide the middle and bottom through scapegoating. Even before the current pandemic and depression, the breakdown in the older economic consensus had resulted in new and sometimes unforeseen political eruptions. Many of these occurred on the right, through the rise of a toxic us-versus-them nationalist politics in the United States and Europe, and the move toward authoritarianism in Eastern Europe, Turkey, and India, and toward a new cyber-totalitarianism in China. There have also, however, been unexpected flare-ups on the political left and center-left. These include a left-wing populism in Southern Europe, the rise of the Greens on the European continent, the attempt by Britain's Labour Party to revive its commitment to socialism, and the awakening in the United States, the bastion of Cold War anti-communism, of a new socialist politics. The principal subject of this book is the rise of a socialist politics in the United States and the failed attempt to revive socialism in Great Britain. Like my previous books on populism and nationalism, I will try to describe and explain these political phenomena. But as a longtime leftist who labored unsuccessfully decades ago trying to create a socialist movement in the United States, and whose hopes for a socialist politics have been rekindled by the Bernie Sanders campaigns, I have definite views on what socialists should and should not do to build a viable movement. In the United States, the revival of interest in socialism has been due to Sanders, who, when he began running for president in 2015, was little known except in Vermont and on the left, and was disdained by some of his colleagues in Congress. Running as a democratic socialist, he almost won against prohibitive favorite Hillary Clinton. 4 years later, Sanders again came in second, consistently winning the greatest share of voters under age 45, voters who hadn't grown up in the shadow of the Cold War and with the identification of socialism with Soviet communism. In an October 2019 YouGov poll, 70% of millennials, ages 23 through 38, said they were extremely or somewhat likely to vote for a socialist. Sanders' failure to win the nomination was predictable, as there are still too many older Americans who associate socialism with the Soviet Union. But Sanders' campaigns had a dramatic influence on the Democratic Party's agenda. A host of Democrats embraced his plan for a single-payer health care system, and his proposal to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, not known as a Democratic Socialist, embraced Sanders' plan to put workers on corporate boards. And Joe Biden, who bested Sanders for the nomination, gave key Sanders supporters prominent places on his policy task forces and crafted a campaign platform that reflected Sanders' influence. The Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, has grown rapidly. In 2015, DSA had 6,000 members. A year after Sanders' campaign, DSA's membership had quintupled. After DSA member Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's election to Congress in 2018, it rose to 56,000, making it the largest Democratic Socialist organization since the pre-World War I Socialist Party. In the wake of the pandemic and depression, it has grown to 70,000. DSA also boasts over 100 office holders. If the United States had a multi-party system with proportional voting, a Democratic Socialist Party might command a very respectable 15 to 20% of the vote. The young people who have taken a positive view of socialism don't necessarily have a worked-out theory of socialism or socialist politics. In the United States, they often identify socialism with Scandinavian countries and with public control of healthcare, education, and energy. They condemn the growing inequality of wealth and power and want a society based on cooperation rather than on cutthroat competition and on sexual and racial equality. They don't envisage the government owning Apple or Microsoft. Sanders' own explanation of democratic socialism runs along these same lines. Some commentators have insisted that neither Sanders nor his young supporters are really socialists. To be a socialist, columnist Eric Leavitt wrote in New York, is to advocate the abolition of profit, or worker ownership of the means of production. Paul Krugman defined socialists as people who want to nationalize our major industries and replace markets with central planning. But that is not what the rising popular sympathy for democratic socialism is about. Socialism is coming back in a form that is different not only from the Soviet Union's or Cuba's communism, but from what socialists who consider themselves to be Marxists have envisaged. And it could play an important role in shaping voters' reaction to what has been the greatest threat to Americans' well-being since the Great Depression and World War II. The Varieties of Socialist Experience. Just as there is no exclusive definition of populism, liberalism, or conservatism, there is no singular definition of socialism. According to Marxist theorist Raymond Williams,
sample complete. Ready to continue?